You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
I know you're not an afternoon person. You're the embodiment of Reagan. You want a nap.
Yeah, there they go again. I like to get up early, drink a lot of coffee, like Teddy Roosevelt, copious amounts of coffee, kick ass for a few hours, and then it's happy hour, Bill.
I'm reading in my presidential book club, which I do through the Coolidge Library, The President and the Assassin, which is about McKinley and his murderer. And I'm really enjoying it. It's actually hard to find a good McKinley book. If you're doing the sort of project, where's the good McKinley book?
I can't tell you how hard I've looked, Bill, over the years.
There's not a lot to work with. But it's an incredibly consequential period. Guy gets murdered. That's interesting, it's the rise of the American Empire, imperialism, Spanish-American War, taking the Philippines, all that kind of stuff. Teddy Roosevelt's in here because Spanish-American War, charging up San Juan Hill. And I'm sure it's not the only book to mention it, but it really lays bare like how farcical the entire war was and how incompetent the charge up San Juan Hill was. And Teddy is being, acting like he's, king of the world. There's this one.
Well, you know what they say, Bill, is print the legend.
So this is one paragraph. The next few moments define the reputation of the young Colonel Roosevelt. Displaying a level of bravery that bordered on foolishness, he led his men from the saddle of his horse, Texas, the name of the horse, Texas, up the slopes of Kettle Hill. Kettle Hill was next to San Juan Hill. Clearly an officer and a prize target, Roosevelt ignored the whizzing Mauser bullets that struck the earth around him and exhorted his men to speed their charge. One bullet grazed his elbow, and Texas was hit several times. Proximity to Roosevelt could prove fatal. Coming across one soldier sheltering behind a small bush, Roosevelt shouted, "Are you afraid to stand up when I am on horseback?" Before Roosevelt could finish bawling him out, the man pitched forward, felled by a round, likely intended for the colonel.
Amazing.
So these guys, there's one other officer who was, struggling. He's like, "Oh, no Spanish bullet can get me." These guys were total
And this has
amateurs.
To do with me drinking a lot. This has to do with me drinking Theodore Roosevelt amounts of coffee. I have not yet drank enough coffee to want to put together a ragtag militia to invade a country, but I've come close. With the Starbucks is very high test, as you know. But Bill, I have to say, last week we did not need caffeine because last week we taped in the morning, and I think we did, and last week we got into the culture wars, and we don't normally go there, but this week I think we take it back a notch. I want to calm things down, and I want to go to your sweet spot. Which is, what is going on with Biff?
Now, are you asking because you're so wrapped up in critical race theory that you haven't been paying attention to Biff?
Well, I'm very active in my work to take down the school board. So this is a hobby of mine, will be talking about infrastructure because my real life is very intertwined with the culture wars.
Well, I got to tell you, Matt, if I look particularly bedraggled and disheveled today, it's because I was up till 3 in the morning. I did a piece. I've written a piece for the Washington Monthly about infrastructure history, legislative history. And it's not published quite yet. Hopefully.
Which is super. I mean, that's a very interesting concept.
Well, let me say two things here. Number one, the website for the Federal Highway Administration. The Federal Highway Administration has an in-house historian, and he has spent decades covering all the minutiae of every infrastructure bill, every transportation bill that has gone through Congress. This is like multiple books worth of information. And so one, this guy is like one of the craziest jobs in the world. And it's just an amazing trove of information to sift through, but it's also completely disorganized on the website. So you can't know if you've really found everything when you stumble onto one page.
So I think I heard somewhere that part of the reason for like the highway, you know, the Eisenhower highway stuff was the ability to like emergency to use highways as like landing strips for airplanes or something to do with the Cold War. Is this, you made a face that made me think that this was.
I didn't read that. I mean, okay. I wasn't looking for that kind of tidbit. So maybe it is in the Federal Highway Administration website somewhere. I didn't come across that.
Well, this was like a surreptitious reason, and it just may be a conspiracy theory.
Well, I mean, there just was a sense that, you know, things need to be modernized. I mean, I'm trying to read as much of this as I can, and I didn't get into this piece about it in the article. You know, the first big national infrastructure bill was under Wilson, which was the Federal Aid Roads Bill. You know, the Democrats in the 19th century were kind of anti national spending on infrastructure. They thought that was outside the bounds of federal power. That was a local matter. Wilson has a much more ambitious scope. But there was debate over what kinds of roads that they should be funding. Do you want interstate trunk roads, as they were called, or roads that are connecting rural areas, and more useful to delivering the mail.
I don't think we should do that because once people can deliver the mail, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to gun confiscation. You know that.
So from what I could glean, it seems like they went the rural route under Wilson. And Eisenhower says, look, we need to modernize. We need a national interstate. There's too many roads that are not paved. Look, they're still dirt roads.
I assume this is inspired by Germany, right?
Possibly. Again, I didn't read that, but that would make some sense.
I'm dropping all sorts. You know what I think? I think there's a Stuff You Should Know podcast about this. And I think I listen to that show sometimes before I go to sleep. So I'm not fully, it's more of a matter of osmosis. And I think that's where I get some of my, half-baked sort of ideas from, but I feel like they did an episode on this. So I
went down this rabbit hole because we're in the middle of infrastructure talks today, and every little hiccup that occurs, there's this knee-jerk reaction that everything must be falling apart. You know, Schumer schedules a cloture vote. And Republicans won't vote for cloture. Everything's in jeopardy. And it just didn't resonate with me that that's how negotiations normally go. There's usually all sorts of bumps and scrapes and twists and turns when it comes to legislation. And so I wanted to see, you know, how long did it take for other big infrastructure bills take to get done? And what kind of obstacles occurred? And my piece is not exhaustive, but I did look at Eisenhower in 56. I did look at Nixon's infrastructure bill in 73. And I looked at George H.W. Bush's in 91, which is considered pretty transformative. The Nixon one was the first time, Eisenhower creates the Highway Trust Fund, which still exists today. And Nixon starts the process of dipping into that fund for mass transit, broadening the scope of what the federal government's involved in. And the Bush 91 bill, which was called Ice-T, is even...
Wait, making that up.
I'm not making that up. It's called Ice-T.
Ice-T?
Yeah. It's like good. Intermodal Surface Transportation Equity Act, something like that.
Wow. Was Ice-T a part of selling it, tell me, please? The rapper?
I think they try to give it a snappy name.
No, but I would hope they would bring in Ice-T
I don't know if there was like Snapple handed out, you know, during the hearings.
Rush Limbaugh used to be a big Snapple advertiser around that time, as I recall. So there could have been some synergy, Bill.
But that bill was meant to, you know, further broaden the scope, you know, more types of projects, more local state input, that kind of thing. Anyway, these things generally took a year and a half to put together. And in the case of the Eisenhower bill, there wasn't that much debate over whether to do it, but how to pay for it. And sort of like today, like Eisenhower wanted to raise taxes, didn't want to increase appropriations, didn't want to issue bonds. It's kind of like you're running out of things that you can use. And this is going to be a $25 billion project, which was, you know, a lot of money at the time. And he creates a commission. The guy running the commission says, okay, we can take the existing gas tax. There was a gas tax already in place for these things. We don't have to raise it because as more and more people drive, it's going to bring in more and more money. And we can issue bonds and pay it back with the increase in gas tax revenue. So it's not really like, it's not hardcore borrowing because we're going to pay it off, you know, reliably. But there was a guy in the Senate was like, you know, borrowing is the devil's work. I'm never going to let you borrow anything for this, as long as I'm standing here. And they just could not get that passed. And they ended up doing, the Highway Trust Fund funded by gas tax. And you're just bringing the gas tax and dedicating that money to highways. But it took a number of tries. Well, they actually brought bills to the floor, full blown bills, put them on the floor and they fail. And the Senate.
See, now this is interesting because the impression is that this was like a golden era, and there was no opposition to building highways and doing infrastructure back in those glory days, right?
When Eisenhower embraced this bond plan, Al Gore Sr. said it was the screwiest plan he'd ever seen in his life.
Well, because he wanted a lockbox for highway funds.
Which they got. Which is exactly what they got. It wasn't Gore's idea, but that's what happened. So they put a bill on the floor and it would fail. And then the House put the White House bill on the floor and it failed. They did an alternate plan with a lot of user fees. And they thought that was going to pass. And when that failed, the Speaker of the House said it was the highway lobby putting all this propaganda so they don't have to pay for the highways that they use. And then Eisenhower had to do another State of the Union address, and he pushed to the State of the Union. Then the highway lobby gave a bit, and that's how you, and then finally got to the compromise. But it took time. And it may well be. So when I look at that, and with the Nixon era, they had a plan to split the difference on transit, and it failed in 72 because the House couldn't muster up a quorum, and they had extend the process over in 73. And still was the Senate wanted the transit money, and the House didn't. And they had a very contentious House Senate conference, but they figured it out. And then with Bush in 91, this was after he raised taxes. This was after the controversial tax increase. And Democrats said this transportation bill should be paid for with another 5 cent gas increase. They called it nickel for America. And Bush was like, I just did this. I got hammered for
not
it.
Gonna bet.
And so he actually did draw a red line and stuck to it. There were lots of veto threats. But eventually
they'll come back to me and they'll say, just a nickel. And I'll say, read my lips.
They eventually accept.
Bill, this is beyond the scope of your piece, but I do want to mention, as an aside, one of my hobbies is, as you know, is new urbanism. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is that we as a country subsidized the automobile and highways, and part of the cost of that was to mass transit. Mm-hmm. Also, the way that we did the infrastructure, I mean, this is really an aside, but, you know, the zoning where we don't have mixed use zoning and where our towns are not walkable, you know, like in Charlestown, West Virginia, if you go to the music store and you want to walk across the street to the Chick-fil-A, you will likely be killed in the process. It's just you can't get there. You can't get there from here or whatever. You can't like cross. There's no like way to cross at the light at the intersection. Mm-hmm. You have to go buy a car, you know, to be able to go across the road. And I know that's not part of this, but you know,
it's not part of this because look, after the Eisenhower bill passed, we now look at it as this wonderful thing that is created the backbone of America, the interstate highway. But it quickly became very controversial after it was implemented because all these roads are being built and there are a lot of local disputes. People started chaining themselves to trees and lying in front of bulldozers. And because
Russell Kirk, who refused to, by the way, that's a cool t-shirt. What's it say? UBU?
Laz, what's your shirt say?
BU.
Okay, but I gotta do this, okay.
She's challenging my cool black shirt thing that I've launched. I think it was Russell Kirk. I forget what he called the. He refused to drive, and he called it like a Jacobin, or I forget what it was. But he thought that the automobile would atomize society and that highways would like disconnect people. Ironically, from their sort of natural state.
Well, that might explain why in Nixon's time, as there was increasing antagonism towards the amount of road building, that Nixon got behind mass transit. And that's why the scope of transportation funding started to broaden. So, you know, what's popular in the abstract, once you get down to the local level, can become very contentious. So that, but to get back to where the direction of my piece, it's not unusual to have pretty intense debate over how to pay for things and the scope of things. Historically, it takes a good amount of time to work out those disputes. Now, you could say, well, look, it still was the 20th century. This is all pre-Fox News. This is when Trump was mere tabloid fodder. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't poisoning all of American society. So just because they got along then and hashed things out in a year's time, Democrats can't wait a year and a half, trusting Republicans are going to come around by mid-2022 or in the lame duck of 2022. They need to lock in some victories right now while they have the numbers, which I totally understand and agree with. So it's not that you can look at that and say Democrats should take their sweet time and not worry. But by the same token, so you can't look at the past and say this means Republicans are silly bargaining in good faith because they had debates before. But you also can't say, oh, they had a disagreement today. They must be negotiating in bad faith. Obviously, this is all a big Lucian and the football scam. Because there's always these kinds of little things that crop up. And so when I look at what's happening with BIF right now, which is as of last night, the group got together. So they've hashed out a lot of their final disagreements. They're not quite there, but they'll have legislative text the next several days. Like, this is within 4 months of Biden's initial proposal. This is like record time for an infrastructure bill.
Now that Republicans have really revealed themselves to be frequently operating in bad faith, even the normal vicissitudes of democracy and of deal making seem to be evidence of, you know, whatever, the Lucy and the football thing.
Well, because the mistrust is so deep. I mean, you have very, very deep mistrust for obvious reasons, for legitimate reasons. And you have very precarious majorities that Democrats are essentially presuming they will lose. They're not, I don't know if they've completely thrown the towel. I wouldn't say that, but they know they could well not have a majority by 2023. And you know, one senator from the wrong state dies, you could lose your majority before then. So they don't want to, you know, waste time, which, again, all understandable concerns. And then the fact that Schumer is having this cloture vote, even though he knows it's not going to pass, the fact that certain House Democrats are openly talking about this being a waste of time, you know, that may be putting constructive pressure on the bipartisan process. Could, you know, this assumes good faith, assumes that people actually want to pass the bill. If you want to pass it, they feel like, okay, we better get over these things. Let's not take a month on crossing the T's. Let's get it done in a week because pressure's on. They're antsy. They don't believe we can do it. Let's show them that we can. So it might all be working out. And if it does, it's going to be, you know, one of the more impressive infrastructure legislative processes in history.
All right, let's get wonky, though. You've alluded to some of this, but get me up to speed. As you know, my large sort of narrative is I felt like Biden messed things up when Republicans were willing to work together. I don't see why Republicans would be willing to sign on to a bipartisan deal if they think Democrats are then going to get everything else in reconciliation. But that's a kind of a global and now dated take. Where are we today? What is the current status? What do I need to know about, and I love saying this, Biff?
Well, from what we can glean again, the possibility still exists that it will fall apart. The possibility exists that Republicans will flinch. So I don't want to say like it's all done here. But from what people have said, Rob Portman, Bill Cassidy, they've all saying we know there's going to be reconciliation. If Democrats want to have reconciliation, that's their business. Just don't link it. Don't, whatever that means, don't link it. Don't make it look like we are handmaidens in reconciliation. We want to oppose reconciliation. Don't hang it around our neck. And Biden has been very aggressive in promoting Biff. Been brought up on its own. And, you know, it may seem cosmetic, but it seems to have given Republicans enough of a comfort zone to say, hey, I can vote for Biff and not be tagged with supporting reconciliation. And Mitch McConnell, there was a political report not too long ago saying that privately, Mitch McConnell said to Republicans, I want you to support infrastructure. I want you to be for this. When we can speculate why he thinks so. But historically, Republicans do like voting for infrastructure. Roads and bridges and even broadband and water doesn't violate their innate conservatism.
I guess there is one theory that says, like, don't give Biden any wins. Don't let him have any victories. But maybe they feel like, big deal if he built, it's not going to like put him on Mount Rushmore, and we can hit him for culture war stuff. That's what drives our voters anyway.
Well, my opinion is I think the incentives driving McConnell and to some extent other Republicans is, number one, if you can be for something, that makes it easier to obstruct other things. Mm-hmm. There's all this narrative that Republicans are completely uncooperative governing partners. You vote for this one thing, you can't lay that rap on them. And they say, hey, we did infrastructure. Don't say we're not. You guys said to work with, we'll work with you. But this other stuff, that's really beyond the pale. I can't do that. So I think they want to have one thing, number one.
Yeah.
As a corollary to that, as I've mentioned before, Republicans, including McConnell, have voted for a bunch of other things already. Smaller bills. But things where if they didn't do it, it would have made things look very dysfunctional. And if the game was make everything look dysfunctional, they would have done it. They clearly think that by doing that, they would look like the bad guy. They would not be able to blame shift onto Biden. So I think that's not the game at hand. To do a corollary, McConnell today said, hey, Democrats, we're not going to vote for a debt ceiling increase. You better do the reconciliation. That's a helpful thing to say. That's not, let's lure him into the debt ceiling trap and then we'll screw him. You know, he's saying, hey, look, if you want to get this done and not have a global economic meltdown, you better do that in reconciliation. Get that out of the way. Give me a heads up here. So I think there's that aspect.
I wouldn't necessarily. I don't have a good Mitch McConnell.
you gotta summon your inner turtle.
I can't do it, but I'm thinking, like, you know, it would be prudent for you to not count on us to keep the country from melting down. I don't know what he would say.
Now, the other thing is, you point about don't give Biden victories. The problem is, with reconciliation, they're going to get a victory one way or the other. You get in on Biff, you deny them sole credit for the victory. You get a piece of it. You get to say, hey, we did the stuff that you like. We did that row. We did that bridge. Yeah. We gave you broadband.
Which I don't think matters in 2024, but in 2022, it could matter if you're running for re-election, right? For Senate
sure.
or House.
Look, if Democrats are delivering things that people like, I mean, like, midterms are usually tough for the president's party, but that's a good way to overcome that normal term of events by getting
what
stuff
I'm saying
done.
Is it's good for incumbents.
Well, right. That's right.
Not just Democrats, but if Republicans are delivering.
Now, it may be that Republicans...
In certain districts, I assume. It's, yeah.
Depends on the district. But Republicans may think, hey, Democrats are going to go overboard on reconciliation. And if they do that, we'll hit them for the inflation down the line to just keep us separate here. But we want the credit for the easy stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is driving their behavior. And that's why I think that just because, Grover Norquist came out. So one of the hiccups was, there was IRS tax enforcement in their pay force. So there's a way to raise revenue without raising taxes. It's existing taxes. You should be paying them. Let the IRS do their job and enforce existing law. You don't want to abolish the police? Well, don't abolish the tax police. Now, Grover Norquist comes in with his anti-tax brigade and says, this is a de facto tax increase. Any good conservative should oppose this. And Republicans started to flinch. And then they had to go back to the drawing room and come up with something else, which they seemingly have done, although I don't know, I haven't read what that thing is yet. Some Democrats said, aha, they found their excuse. They found their reason to bolt. You know, they're going to take any stupid thing and they're going to walk away from it. But, you know, it was $100 billion over, you know, several years.
Yeah.
So it comes out to like, you know, $10, $15 billion a year. It's not that much money. And if you're going to bolt on that, I mean, that would give Manchin and some of the excuses to say, hey, you guys weren't serious. We're going to go whole hog on reconciliation now. So it just never struck me as – I don't think Republicans can get away with that kind of game, find a rinky-dink, illegitimate reason to walk away because it just makes you look petty and foolish and then give it, and then lets Democrats get credit for everything. So that kind of stuff doesn't strike me as reason to believe it's all going to fall apart.
Well, it seems like in the progressive commentary, there is there are a lot of people who just want to declare the fix is in. Republicans, you can't trust them. They're never going to work with us. And maybe that's right. Maybe it's wrong. You seem to be more resilient and accepting of the fact that, like, compromise and democracy is messy inherently. And we just have to keep plugging away.
Well, you have to at least know that the legislative process is inherently messy. I mean, this doesn't mean this deal is going to get done. But if you're more familiar with that history, you don't have the same knee-jerk reaction to seeing it today. There are people, there are millennials who've probably never even seen the real negotiation before. Who don't know how these things can be. If you're AOC, you've barely been in Congress. You've never seen this stuff up close. So your reaction is going to be different. But having said that, there is also genuine dislike of the BIF on the left. And this goes maybe a third incentive for the Republicans. You point out, well, Democrats are still getting their reconciliation. They're still going to spend a lot of money. Yes and no, because Biden has said the caps that we put on physical infrastructure in the BIF will remain. We're not going to blow those caps in reconciliation. We're just going to fund other things entirely. But the agenda items in the BIF, those levels, they stay. And AOC and others left don't like that. DeFazio, Pierre DeFazio, is the House Transportation Chair, said the best thing that could happen is this whole thing falls apart. He would rather it not happen. And they just do a partisan bill. So right, Bill. Republicans are successfully restraining how much Democrats can do here.
Bill, quick quiz question. Famous TV sitcom character named DeFazio. Go.
Laverne DeFazio, Laverne and Shirley.
Okay. That's too easy.
I mean, what, who are you talking to here?
What was Shirley's last name?
I should know. But I don't remember. I don't remember Shirley.
I'll come back with it next week.
you don't even know yourself. You can't ask a question.
Wasn't it something like Phoebe or something?
That sounds right. That sounds
something
right.
Weird. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure, though.
Fabrizio?
So let's just put a fine point on it. Maybe we can have a short episode today. So even in the halcyon glory days when of the 1950s, when Dwight Eisenhower, this moderate Republican, and everything was functioning perfectly, of course, in America, this is like, you know, I mean, unless you're a minority or, of course, you know, there's so many people who hearken back to the 1950s as this like utopia. How hard was it, or how long did it take them to actually pass the highway bill?
I mean, there was a tiny highway bill done in 54. Then right after, Vice President Nixon comes out with an official proposal to do a 10-year multi-billion dollar bill. That was summer of 54. And they signed the bill in, I think it was spring 56. So, you know, it was almost 2 years. And it was similar about a year and a half for the 73 bill and for the 91 bill.
We're at what point now? 3 months in to this?
Yeah, like 3.5 months. And these are pretty big bills we're talking about here. You know, perhaps we should recognize that it's a different time, internet age, things move faster, all that kind of stuff. But I think the bigger issue is that Democrats feel like they're on a short leash, and they're putting pressure on the system, and it would seem constructively so. It's a very fine line between constructive pressure and being ham-fisted.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to be pushing Republicans to the breaking point, which suggests these Republicans actually want to have this bill done. And some people think that Manchin does this performatively so he can justify going partisan later, the Manchin cycle. But I think if you're Manchin, you're Sinema, you don't spend this much time talking about bipartisanship unless you want to prove that you can make bipartisanship work. I think they want to show they can do it. And I think the Republicans want to show that they can do it. And that's further incentivizing them to get through all these sticking points.
All right. So I'm looking up Laverne and Shirley here. Penny Marshall played Laverne DeFazio. Cindy Williams played Shirley Feeney.
Feeney, right.
That sound right?
That does. Well, yes, it is right.
What did I say? I said Phoebe, didn't I?
Right. But Feeney is correct. Yes.
So I was close.
Yes.
So you give me like 70, 75%?
I mean, if this was Jeopardy, you would lose.
Shirley Feeney. Okay. Well, you learned something. Even if you didn't pick up anything about infrastructure, now your pop culture knowledge is just that much better.
if not for the interstate, could Laverne and Shirley have traveled from Milwaukee to Hollywood?
And not only that, could their entire friends, their network of friends and family have also moved with them. And not only that, could they have skipped in time? Weren't they like in the 1950s and all of a sudden, didn't they go from like 1955 to like 68 or something like instantly?
You might think of Quantum Leap.
I think... This is your one Google search away from knowing the answer to this. But I feel like there was some time travel involved on that highway. Maybe they got the car up to 88 miles an hour. I'm not sure.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about before we sign off?
No.
Do you think the deal is going to happen?
I put it this way. I am much more bullish than I was. You remember, I think earlier, I don't think I officially declared it over, but I said I would be surprised if it happened. Now I'm leaning toward yes.
All right.
You've talked me into it, Bill.
You know, the other interesting thing of that I do want to mention quickly is, you know, Pelosi said before that she wouldn't pass the bipartisan bill until they pass reconciliation. And I point out that some of her wording has been a little fuzzy and that she may treat the budget resolution as sufficient and not wait for the final reconciliation bill. And, you know, no one's clarified that as of yet, but I feel like the resolution negotiations are being hyped up so much that it's going to feel like this great success if Democrats come together on a top line, that it will be easier for Pelosi to say, hey, well, that's what I meant. I meant this. I meant this resolution. Now we can take your bipartisan bill now, because the bipartisan bill is probably going to get done, I think, before the August recess, where there's no way reconciliation gets done for the August recess. They'll do the resolution by then. Reconciliation is going to take more time. I think it's going to be a push from Biden, from House moderates who are in vulnerable districts, to go to Pelosi to say, look, this is done. Let's sign this and pocket this win. You know, I'm not saying take that prediction to the bank or anything, but I do feel like there are stars aligning for that to occur.
So, speaking of Pelosi, did you see that she rejected Jim Jordan?
Yes,
I did. From that January 6th commission, and then I guess Kevin McCarthy. That's it.
Kevin Feeney.
Phoebe. Kevin Phoebe. Kevin Phoebe, I guess, pulled all of them, right? All the nominees. Did that happen?
Yeah, I heard that, and I think you could have seen it coming from a mile away that this was never going to come together. I mean, like, there's polarization in Washington, but it's kind of, you know, contained towards anything Trump-related. And it takes the pressure off the infrastructure process. They get a little slower 1-6.
What does it say, though?
$4 trillion
of the larger question is, what does it say that it was easier for me to recall? I came closer to getting the name right of a 1970s sitcom character than the current House Minority Leader. Is that a bad sign?
For him, I mean, he's not someone who has made a great impression on the national public.
I hope it says more about him than it does about me, Bill.
All right. I am away next week.
And I think I'm away the next week. So could, you know, it's possible we may go 2 weeks.
Well, if you don't want to get a sub, I'll see what I can do while the week you're away. So we'll pull people in the dark for too long.
Yeah, I don't think the public can go 2 weeks without one of us. So we'll have your people call my people. I will. We'll see you in a couple weeks, I guess. We'll be in touch. I'll text you daily from the beach. Check out my stuff at The Daily Beast. Check out my podcast, Matt Lewis in the News. And Bill, what do you want to plug?
I did have a piece about Biden and antitrust and the history of Democrats and antitrust over at the Washington Monthly. So check that out.
Awesome. All right. We'll see you guys here in the DMZ sometime.
Take care.
Bye.